going on record.
It's on.
Yes. All right. Wanted to just remind everybody the schedule, and I, unless there are changes, I'll double check with Renata, I think we will go ahead and switch it then from 3 to 5 for the remaining meetings in October, November, December. Last I checked, that worked for folks, but if is that still workable? I know, Lori, at the end you get crunched, but 3 to 5 instead of 2 to 4, mm-hmm. same dates. Okay.
Just send that reminder.
Yeah, I will. And first, I want to verify if it still works or for not, because it will help Paul. He may still have some issues, but I think it's going to. He said, that would increase his ability to participate. So if it doesn't cause problems for others, we'll go there. Again, the next meeting is going to be October 4th, then from 3 to 5 o'clock. I'd suggest, look, the backstop for the property fences in some ways is the November 3rd deadline. We've got a couple more meetings after today before then, but
a couple or one?
A couple. November 1st we have a meeting also. I mean, right beforehand. So I just say, I don't know, as we get in property funds, if we need to prioritize our time, bigger issues, I want to reiterate to everybody, we're happy to meet individually with anybody. If you have kind of just detailed questions or want to talk through some stuff, right. But the group time is at this point getting more limited. I'd suggest, again, for the next meeting, maybe adding in to the reading the fraud report. I think it was number 11. Just put that into the mix again. Number 10 is the fraud. And we'll leave number 11 as kind of the new material for the November 1st meeting. All right. Well, that said... with Renata not here, let me ask Laura, is there anything you wanted to talk about with respect to, we addressed some of the PDO's comments previously, but not kind of the main first point about the repeat offender penalty enhancements. Do you want to talk about that now? Anything in particular you want to raise?
No, I don't think so.
Okay. Well, then the only other, unless... anybody else wanted to address that? The only other thing we would carry over from the last meeting would be attempts, right? We had the kind of ended last time with this conversation from USAO about hail stock and just sorting that out a bit. But Renata really needs to be here for that. So maybe we should put a bookmark on that, come back to it when she comes in. I know I want to try to put that though first. As soon as Renata's available. So moving on then to property offenses and the definitions. And again, kind of suggested we start with the report number 8 recommendations. I will pull it up on the screen too. And Dave, I should check too. There wasn't anything else that we hadn't addressed. Was left over on the enhancements and attempt stuff that you wanted to raise.
No.
Good. All right. So, property fences and the definition section. So again, this first draft of report number 8 kind of includes three main parts. One is this laundry list of definitions applicable to property offenses, but it also includes these other two sections on aggregation and how to deal with a multiple conviction for multiple related property offenses. Okay, so these kind of corresponds to the current provisions we right now have in Chapter 32. We have these list of definitions applicable to the theft chapter. We have an aggregation statute, and then we have right now, which is the consecutive sentences statute, right? So this kind of tracks that. Of course, it brings in within the property offense subtitle in that regime a number of property offenses that right now are outside of Title 32, right? You know, arson, malicious destruction of property, some of the fraud type offenses, B&E vending machines, a number of these things which, for whatever reason, were separated out historically. So we're bringing them all so that all of these definitions would apply throughout, right? Which is itself a kind of macro level change. You know, property of another, property. A lot of the basic definitions for the theft chapter actually aren't defined for a lot of the property offenses outside of the current theft chapter, at least not statutorily defined. So just by bringing all these organizationally within the same subtitle, we hope to kind of have much more consistent definitions crossing through property offenses. Going through the different definitions, you know, we would be happy to address any questions, but you know, first prioritize if there are particular concerns or
points. Oh, we can go through them.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think if there's anything, does that make sense? So yeah, just on property offense definitions, initial thoughts or questions.
Coercion.
Yeah.
Anything about that?
You bet.
Okay. Ridicule.
Ridicule.
How does Webster define ridicule as opposed to something like embarrassment?
Gotcha. Good question. And Bryson, this is actually one that Bryson did work on, so he might know where that exact language we had drawn from for that.
But. So a lot of the stuff that's in coercion is actually part of either extortion or blackmail in the current code. So we've amalgamated a lot of those prongs into one definition. I think that the hatred, contempt, or ridicule comes from blackmail, the current blackmail statute.
I should be able to find that here.
But if it's not, it's from extortion. It's 3251.
And do you remember which offenses uses? Is it the blackmail and extortion offense?
So extortion has it, as well as financial exploitation of a vulnerable adult, I think, uses coercion.
Blackmail does have the ridicule. I've got it up on the screen now. So this is the current blackmail statute, that same hatred, contempt, or ridicule. I can try to do it side by side, but that's a bit too much.
So let's say I
fight action.
What?
What was that, Don?
I'm just curious why Dave is asking.
Well, I was thinking about, and it may not play out in these crimes, but I was thinking about something like, if you don't do this, I'll release the nude photograph kind of thing, which I'm not sure is ridicule. It may be embarrassment, it may be something else. And that's why I was asking. And I could think of a lot of other things that people would succumb to blackmail about
sure. That
may not be within those three definitions.
So that's true, and it's very possible. I mean, first, we do have the new revenge pornography statute, which doesn't exactly get too coercive, like,
yeah,
do this or I will release it, but I think would, I mean, I don't know. I haven't spent a lot of time looking at that, but would certainly seem to cover some of that conduct. The other thing, one of the things that we added, and this was, this is not, this would be, I guess, new to district law, that a lot of other states have and the model penal code has, is the final subsection, subsection 5J, which is kind of a residual thing to kind of catch things like that that might not squarely fall into some of the other ones. So again, would releasing the nude photos cause material harm to another person's health, safety, business, career, reputation, or personal relationships?
Sure.
Possibly, you know, right? So
but it is, you know, it's
possible.
Purposely,
yeah,
vague at that bottom end.
Right.
You know, it's material harm to provide, you know, some level of...
Yeah. And again, this isn't a so this is a definition that's used in criminal offenses with other elements. Like, this in and of itself is not an offense. Obviously, a lot of this would fall within First Amendment stuff. Some of this is even arguably laudatory if you're not doing it to coerce someone, et cetera, et cetera. So,
this just raises a kind of broad point that I've put on everybody's radar as you're kind of reading through the different statutes. You know, we did not go out of our way, and some jurisdictions do draft this way, but it becomes very tricky, to always kind of refer to perform any other acts in an illegal manner, for instance, or some way of statutorily inserting the fact that, oh yeah, some of the conduct we're describing might be constitutionally protected or otherwise justified, right? And at if you do that every single time, one, you always run the risk then of failing to mention at some points where the conduct, you don't mean there to be a caveat. So again, what we've left out, even though it's defined this way, and you know, it's something we could change the drafting style, or I think also importantly, you know, we can just need to be careful in the commentary to kind of reflect this fact that, right, some of this conduct might be constitutionally protected, right? And so it's not, another instance, sorry, this is too general, but give a more specific example. You know, we've talked before about revising statutes to say that, for instance, a police officer, it's not theft if your property is seized by the police as part of a suspected contraband, as part of a case, or as, you know, evidence, okay? You could specifically draft to that, right, to make clear that, seizures by the, this is not criminal, but we haven't done that, okay? So, again, the idea being that this is a general justified use and would not be criminal behavior. So this, just as a kind of a macro level drafting style, that's what we've done. It is something to be kind of aware of, and I think again, our preference would be is where it's unclear in some instances, we need to, we can address it in the commentary, maybe in the statute, but again, I'm wary about getting in the situation where in a few statutes we go out of our way, for instance, to clarify that, this doesn't apply to, otherwise legally authorized seizure by a government official. Okay, well, for most property offenses, you can say something, right? Like, copying, illegal copying. Well, and if it's the court making copies, to distribute the on-bank, we just kind of can't fully imagine that, and we want to be careful not to kind of neglect to address all those circumstances. So rather than...
I don't think that's an issue. I can't imagine anyone wanting you to go through and put it in everywhere. That just seems...
Yeah, everywhere, I think that's right, but it, we do see it in a number of other jurisdictions, at least in some instances, right? And it does then beg the question, well, then why aren't you seeing it in other instances? And property offenses, I feel like receiving stolen property is a place where this crops up sometimes. Anyway, our approach, just...
If it goes anywhere, I would put it in the notes.
Right, the commentary, yep. Yeah, and I think that's...
Yeah, I mean, part of it goes to the fact that we're not incorporating general defenses. I mean, these are all general defenses,
right.
Model Penal Code, and those places that have incorporated defenses speak to all these, and so typically there's that backdrop. It's in the same way that self-defense is a defense to every offense against person in the D.C. Criminal Code, notwithstanding the fact that no particular offense
references
it.
Yeah.
So.
And Don, just so you know, Renata joined us. Renata, Don's on the phone, but is the other person. And we actually have a member of the public today also. So,
member of the public?
No, member of the public in the back there.
Look at how you. I'm Kelly. I'm a junior at UW.
Okay.
Here, so.
It's good.
Great. Well, anything more on coercion that addresses the initial point? Maybe I'd say maybe we should jump back to attempt now that Renata's here, if that's all right. Or do you want a minute?
It's fine. I'm frazzled.
I'm sorry.
I think the point on this that I was making at the last meeting was I think we've made it clear that so far we believe that you are hewing very close to the extent that you can to any pronouncements by the DC Court of Appeals. Here, I'm not sure that it makes a great deal of difference ultimately, but we think that there was short shrift given to some of the case law, and that there was actually some confusion in your effort to try to explain that.
Sure.
There was some confusion created. And we think that just needs to be worked out. So,
would the solution really then just like looking at the commentary to clarify, particularly, so we should review that to see again around the Hailstock decision that we just.
Exactly.
I think we had a meeting of minds. I think, and it's just a matter of like making sure the commentary reflects the fact that it was a drafting issue for the commentary. It sounds like more than a substantive error.
That's
is
right.
That fair?
Okay. That's right.
Good. Any other on attempt, or actually, you know, anything more on enhancements or attempt before we just kind of scoot back to the property fence land? All right, good, great. So property fence land. Let me go back. And Renata, just so you know, we just started looking. We were looking at the coercion definition.
I'm good on coercion.
Yeah, and David,
right.
Just
I think it fits under J. A bunch of the different examples I have.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
I didn't think about it.
Sure. Bryson's point. You know, this is largely drawn from the current blackmail and extortion statutes. But it goes further, right? Like, you know, and it goes further because this is really standard type of stuff for particularly this kind of catch-all thing. We've seen other jurisdictions. Again, this is written up in the commentary, but just a flag that, like, you know, there is some changed language here. Again, it's highlighted in the commentary. Going through other definitions.
My next one is deceive, and this is... perhaps
okay.
An easier one. It's the lack of parallelism between A through D and E.
Okay.
Deceive and deception means provided that. And that's just something, I mean, that's just a drafting technique I think we have to work
That's
through.
Right. That's right. Well, so it's a fair question. This was like one of these kinds of, I remember this a bit. So Janu had kind of worked on this, so
I'm not quibbling with the language or the intent as much as the parallelism.
Yeah.
It has to read when
That's
you
right.
break it into an A.
That's right.
1, 2, 3 and a B, or however you want to do it, but it should be parallel construction.
Good. We'll make a note of that, and I think you're right. The idea was, and we need to use better syntax to communicate that is that AE. Is a caveat to all of the above, to A through D. But yeah, maybe breaking it just up into a separate
sentence. Sub-paragraph. And, so, you know, so you have a me, you know, I don't know.
Yeah. Good.
There's a lot of information there.
And I will say, too, like, look, you know, this, this definition he drew from several other kind of sources. You know, it's hard, right? And this is where, you know, fraud type offenses are.
I'm not arguing with the language.
Yeah, well, I'm just wanted to kind of put out there and flag for everybody that you know, we're trying to go the extra mile on this in the sense that a lot of jurisdictions still, it's interesting, even those that have tried to address the fraud language, fail to do so because. It's hard to cover as the breadth and diversity of fraudulent behavior that you know that's, and yet to do so precisely. So, you know, we took our best shot looking at other authorities for language that, again, we don't think is going to narrow the statute, certainly as it's used now, but provides some greater specificity. We went over a few. Does anything on consent, did that raise anything for anybody?
Can I ask a, it's not yep. alphabetical order.
Nope.
But since these are property offenses, it's essential. Maybe it doesn't matter. So what makes me think of it is in the definition of property, it's tangible or intangible, personal property.
Yeah.
And maybe it's too complicated. Maybe everyone will say, nobody does this and just come into the 21st century. But it worries me that we throw an intangible, right, that we're rewriting a bunch of offenses that really are about property, and then, which doesn't mean that we shouldn't in some way deal with intangible, but I worry we write stuff because we know, like theft, right, where what we really mean is this, but we have this definition, which is more expensive. Are we going to end up with trouble? Like, I feel like if you had tangible property and intangible property, you'd have to think every time, wait, do I really mean, you know, so for example, I couldn't remember the term, but I had to look it up, like business goodwill, right? Like there's stuff that sometimes maybe that is something we want to include on something, right? Extortion or something. I'm going to tell everyone there's rats in your business or in Georgetown Cup, whatever. But there must be times when we don't mean the intangible. And maybe it gets written in a way that it can't, like theft, right? I was just looking at. Like, it maybe couldn't be interpreted to mean, because it really is deprive. And I mean, like, it implies physical stuff.
Because occupant means a person holding a possessory interest in the property, so I am occupying the intangible property.
Right. So it forces, like, it just... worry we're going to... I don't know. Maybe we don't have to parse it out. Maybe we'll end up writing the physical... When we mean physical, we're already using verbs that imply physical or something. But I just wonder if we're going to pass over something we should be sensitive to because we have this definition that is really broad.
Yeah.
Is it doing too much work? Does anybody tackle that? On the other hand, thinking of sort of the work we were trying to do on discovery in Rule 16, which is so clearly like written as if, like, here's a piece of paper, you shall turn over a piece of paper, and so then doesn't, like, it's too property, physical bound, and gets too confusing. Like, well, wait, does that mean data? Does that mean meta? You know, so I also don't want to end up with something where we're too narrow and it can't move into sort of the modern world.
Sure.
So the answer could be like, get over it, Laura. Stop trying to stall because you didn't read chapter 9. That's fine. but it does bother me and worry me. Just saying.
And obviously with my occupant, there were other issues with how the words were about the definitions.
Sure. On the property point. So on the screen now, this is the... Again, sorry about the glare. That's the current definition, which, you know, is essentially mirrored here. So the current definition does include tangible or intangible personal property. But here's the thing. I wholly agree with your basic sentiment that, you know, when this arose as part of the 1982 Theft and White Collar Crime Act, you know, there's a little bit in the legislative history that's like, this is expansive. You know, we mean this property here to be expansive, and they included this, you know, tangible or intangible personal property. There is no other evidence besides that intellectual property was in the minds of the council. It is not manifest at all in the legislative history that the whole 1982 Theft and White Collar Crime Act that brought this in for theft, fraud, all these core offenses, that they had their eye on intellectual property thefts and intellectual property. Like, there's no evidence of it that I recall from the legislative history. So I think it's a fair point. I think it's a point which, like, also it does raise unique questions that, frankly, don't often come up, right? You know, and maybe more white-collar crime folks, you know, would be attuned to this. I don't know. But so our thought was put it in, keep it in, the law as it is right now. But I agree we should be particularly thoughtful about this. You know, some of the issues, you know, credit, you know, the notions of value changing, you know, some of these already, you know, we have statutes governing, you know, video recordings, you know, things with digital content. Like, I don't know, in some ways we're crossing over a bit into this area already, kind of even by the normal kind of crimes that are rooted in physical objects. But I agree we should be alert to this. We, you know, again, I don't think we saw in our drafting of any of the property offenses. I think maybe it came up more in fraud. And Januma, if
this issue comes up.
To it. Yeah. And again, this how much intangible property may or may not be at issue.
You mean in the application of a particular offense?
Yeah. So I would just say, like, right, our approach has been leave it in, be wary of it, because I agree. I don't think, again, we didn't see evidence that it was kind of very thoughtfully included in the 1982 Theft and White Collar Crime Act. There hasn't been litigation around it, right? This property of definition is nothing, right? And again, it's a non-exclusive list even, right? You know, includes but is not limited to. So, that's our approach. If you have other thoughts, and I would say, like, it's not something that we feel like we're great experts in either, right? We've been trying to follow the literature on some of this stuff, but, like, so if you see any of these, you know, property offenses which have unique application, again, as applied to the intellectual property, let us know. We'd really appreciate it. As to the overlap with occupant, did you want to?
Well, can we go back?
Okay.
Because I've got a bunch earlier in the alphabet.
Okay. Good.
So the next one that I had was dwelling.
Yep.
And I bodied the difference between lodging and residing overnight.
Okay.
My father-in-law always worked nights. So where did he... So his... Where he slept didn't count, because it's not overnight. Mm-hmm. So I think actually that definition, the concept I agree with, as you explained in the commentary, but I think by using the term overnight, you're limiting the application of it to people who might use that same room or location for daytime sleeping. So I just put that out there for your consideration.
Sure.
But the design is still, like, what isn't a dwelling is my kids' daycare. They are not in daycare anymore. But when they used to be, there was sleeping. Well, in theory, during nap time, somebody slept. Not my children. Right, but design...
Design, so...
So let's say you have a resident at GW Hospital who's on a 48-hour shift, and their nap time with the bed is 10 to 2 in the daytime. Isn't that exactly what we're looking for? If it's a room set aside for that purpose, even though it's not a dwelling because it's in GW Hospital?
Sure. Yes. And
it's...
Yeah.
And is that a dwelling? So when I slip
it's
in...
It's not
and
a dwelling. They say that. It says dwelling for lodging, but that are used for lodging or residing overnight. So they separate dwelling from overnight, which is why I'm focusing on that. In the commentary.
So hospitals are, you know...
I'm just giving that as examples of places that are set aside for the same purpose that you're... Otherwise, it would all be dwellings, right?
So you
meant a separate concept from dwelling when you said overnight. Yeah. I'm just saying that same idea could happen during the day as well as overnight. That's my point.
So your recommendation would be just eliminate the overnight. Would that kind of address your concern?
If you are more expansive on what you mean by dwelling in the commentary. Or to say, you know, in the, or residing to sleep, or I don't know, some some other word that describes the same concept that you are using.
What's
but I think
resign?
It's a valid point.
But do you resign overnight or do you lodge overnight?
Well, yeah, I was going to say, what's the difference between lodging and residing?
Well, it actually says, but that are used for lodging or residing overnight.
Which I think is a strange phrasing, because you can reside somewhere without lodging there overnight. You work for the post office and you work the night shift, so you're never there at night sleeping. But that is your, in fact, legal residence.
Right.
Versus a motel, versus a hotel even, because we associate with motels some activities that may not cause you
to
stay or sleep, certainly, overnight. So
lodging is temporary, and residing is permanent.
That's right.
Yes.
Everyone else knew that.
Well, no, not necessarily. Not necessarily.
That was our intent, I think, was the lodging-residing distinction is one of permanence or length permanence. And we wanted to also distinguish, actual use versus this design notice, right?
So I think to answer your question, I personally think that if you just end it with residing, it would be fine. There's actually use for lodging or residing.
Yeah, and just
it's the overnight that gives me heartburn.
Gotcha. You bet.
But only for the actual use, not for the design.
That's right.
That's right. And
then change the commentary to management.
I would want to kind of check with the rest of the staff, but that seems to make sense. I don't think we were trying to draw an overnight distinction in particular. And again, in general, I will say, where is dwelling cropping up? As we kind of, in some of these offenses, kind of move from more common law land for arson and whatnot, there's a lot of different and often kind of conflicting policies around why dwellings are treated differently, different rationales are offered. I think, the thrust of it is, a higher expectation of safety and privacy in those, what we would trying to get at here with the dwelling, and also potentially a higher degree of risk, which is to say if a crime occurs in a dwelling, unlike other more public places, you might be very isolated. It's both scary, it's invasive from a privacy sense, but it's also potentially more dangerous. So what work is that doing?
See what you're getting at. So I think the problem is residing overnight, because I get what you mean by lodging. Like, you don't own the thing, but it's meant for you to be able to use it temporarily that way. And what you mean by residing overnight is not so much literally residing overnight, but the thing is residential in nature versus commercial, right? It's not a store that I'm in. Although there's always that thing about the thing that's on top is residential in nature, and whether you have access to it from below or whatever. But isn't that what you really mean, that it's residential in nature?
What was the answer to what they were trying to do? Where does the room where the residents sleep at GW, is that in or out?
It's in, right? Because it's a unit of a thing that's designed for...
It's
sort of, kind of,
night,
but
right?
I assume anyone who's got a key can come in. It's not the same level of privacy. I mean, it's not like I could lock it and...
But it's not property of another. It is property.
So
somebody else has the right to infringe upon it.
No, but I was thinking about burglary.
Oh, burglary.
Right? Somebody comes in, I'm the resident, somebody comes in and takes my wallet. Is it a dwelling? Certainly, if I'm sleeping, that's a certain kind of vulnerability. On the other hand, people are in and out all the time with their own shifts. It's not, right? So it's, it's not...
Yeah.
My sense of safety in that place, where lots of people might be in and out, is not the same as the sense of safety in my home or the hotel room, where I can lock the door and decide who comes in and who comes out. I decide who comes in and who comes out.
But we distinguish a dormitory from the classrooms and the lecture halls at the university, right? And so it is about this thing about how terrible, it's bad enough that you are breaking and entering and taking somebody's things, but we think that it is worse where people are going to be expected to be inside of there, and goodness knows.
But the problem's not
going to
be the dorm. The problem's going to be the dorm room, right? If all I do is get into the lounge,
dorm hall.
I think that's probably true. I think that we would under the law say that there is probably, I don't know. That would be a. That's one
if
of those places. Is
you're
going to
get me
argument.
In each dorm room.
Yeah.
But if
yeah.
I'm only
but
in the lounge,
then we're going to have some.
How about a
litigation? You're right.
Yeah.
How about
so
the
barracks on a
where it's got six cots in the room and the social sleep.
The same
room.
As the GW. Right?
I think that's
it's,
the same.
I mean, as the hospital, the residence
lobby. It doesn't have the.
It's
a, but it's
the same.
It's the
used for sleeping.
It's
yeah.
used for
it's
sleeping,
used,
but too many people
purpose,
in and out.
Right.
With the people sleeping there,
and
not being able to control
them. Yeah, that at a dorm, there've been times when you're pulling an all nighter, you might wake up and find yourself in the common area.
Okay.
So
for other reasons. I was always studying.
24/7, no
but
sleep.
But I'm not judging. Yeah. Yeah.
No, of course.
But you heard me.
I heard things. I live in the world.
So I will say this, like I think these points are right. And you know, we, you know, years back when we had initially broached this in the context of like arson, maybe to some degree burglary at the Sentencing Commission even, right? Like there are hard borderline examples, right? That we can find on these things. And they have to do with, right, places that are more transiently used, that mix up this kind of traditional residential
arson.
Commercial thing. Oh yeah.
Yes.
So
how many counts do I get when I set the dorm on fire?
Yeah.
Versus something that
versus
breaking
into
a person
room.
To be
so
in, and yet a homeless person
yeah.
might
yeah.
Well, we had that.
There.
So,
okay.
So
well, apparently, I'm going to have to read this.
Right. You'll have to read it. And
why
so I would
you answer this because I think it's important to be honest. Whatever people in my profession, I like to be honest.
That's
saying.
Why
I'm
randomly
just like,
put highlighting.
Should have done.
I might have a transcription of this specifically that.
What?
There.
I'm an honest person. Where's the recording?
Speaking on behalf of the public defender,
all right. I'm not ready for trial. Can I have a continuance, please?
So I would say this. Like, I would suggest, and we could do this now, but I'm a little wary to do that if folks haven't really looked at the arson and burglary definitions fully, which you weren't expected to necessarily for this
you
meeting.
Got highlighting.
Okay. Some of folks might have the highlighting.
Because
how it applies, I mean, this is,
that.
In the abstract, this is an impossible definition, right? To have crisp lines on. And what we want to try to do is, as applied for the few offenses where it shows up, does it do the work that we need?
Yeah.
I would say a couple things. The, you know, looking at other jurisdictions, this is as good or better than pretty much anything. Like we there is no silver bullet out there that other jurisdictions have for defining this. Again, how it plays out in their particular arson or burglary offenses depends. Another thing you'll see when you kind of look at our burglary and arson offenses is how the mental states go, right? So it's one thing to say, you know, is it in fact, you know, as a matter of strict liability, a dwelling? It's another one, did the person have to know it was, right? You know, and that goes to, like, you know, the would-be burglar going into a hospital room not knowing it's the place where the residents are sleeping. But if it's, you know, clearly, you know, so that's another level to it, and we address that some in the individual offenses, right? What culpable mental state applies to this, the fact that it is a dwelling. The other thing I'd say is in ours, you know, it's in the gradations, right? So, Bryce might correct me if I'm wrong, but I think for all of them, like, dwelling just gets you the more severe gradation. But, you know, underlying that, you're still going to have liability for it as a building or as another location. So ultimately what hangs on this is not so much is it criminal or is it not, it's whether it's the degree of punishment. Yes, Laura.
What?
well, I didn't read. I think I should be good in some other way. Picking up on both of you, I think, were saying, don't we want to make a suggestion of taking it overnight entirely?
Yeah.
Because that just focuses on the sleeping.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Right?
That's why I said put
but you only want to take it under the use. Right. Yeah. Right. Like Renata was saying, it's about the residential. Right. Whatever I'm doing, it's a residence. I'm either lodging or residing there.
Right.
So which also then takes care of the every once in a while I sleep in my office. I fall asleep in the lounge. Right? It is because I was sort of thinking just because you happen to use it once overnight or to sleep, is it right? It's the overnight implies that what you are doing with that place, whereas yeah. you could reside someplace and it's not about sleeping there or not sleeping yeah. there, it's your residence. And that's more what the test we want, right?
That's right. I mean, so for example,
even though it'll get played out in whatever, everything you just said.
If one of your colleagues is, this is hypothetical.
It's about to be scandalous.
No. So, okay, when I was at the law firm, a colleague was going through a divorce. It became apparent that that person was sleeping at the office. That did not convert that law firm, in my opinion, to a residential facility or a dwelling.
So
it was still a commercial thing.
The question, one of the questions that we were trying to address that actually used are situations like someone sleeping out of their car, like a person who's homeless is sleeping out of their car. Well, they're not homeless per se. I guess they have a car to sleep in. But there's, you know, situations wherein a place that isn't really designed to be occupied like a residence would should be included.
Right, but
it could be converted.
So I guess what we did is we separated those two concepts into two clauses, designed for and actually used for, where maybe actually it sounds like you guys are saying lodging or residence are doing that work instead.
No, I don't know, because the car, I don't know.
So, which is to say,
that's a good point. I'd like to look up lodging to see all of their meanings. Oh, we have a dictionary here. By the way, it was Samuel Johnson's 300th birthday just the other day, right? Speaking of dictionaries.
Bryson probably knew that.
It sounds like the basic concepts should be included. It's just a question of how to include them.
Wait,
so
what you're
we can,
getting at is both in the context of burglary and especially, I would say, in the context of arson.
Right.
There are times when you're thinking about penalty and gradation, and there are these things that generally aren't residences or meant for overnight sleeping, but they get converted into what may come under lodging. Maybe you're lodging in your car because you have nowhere else, or you're lodging in this little shanty-like thing that maybe was like an equipment room, but you're in there because you're homeless or whatever. So I guess we should think about lodging or residence that might be enough, where you might be able to delete overnight.
I will say, I think our what was in our heads would have included the example you gave as a dwelling, where one night I stay overnight, but if it's known, for instance, again, it kind of goes to mental state issues, but the cleaning person knows that somebody lives there or is living in their office and, then goes in to commit a, theft from there or, a criminal act, right? Would that be burglary? Has that been converted? And I think, at some point, I think we would say the actual use does make that a dwelling. Now, is it known or not? Should that be known? How that works into the gradations?
You mean currently like a B1 as a current?
Yeah, exactly, right.
A B2.
Exactly, right. And we preserve some of these distinctions, right, between dwelling versus buildings versus other places. Honestly, though, I think I suspect both judges, or if it's a matter of pleas, these while it might bump you into a box for greater liability, these points would be argued right before the and as a matter of sentencing, it isn't clear to me how some of these borderline cases would shake out. I don't know. But I would say look at the way we've kind of set up the gradations and see if that partly addresses your concerns. Again, no place has cracked this. Usually, I will say there's some different strains, particularly with respect to arson, but also in burglary, where, again, in the common law, dwelling was a main feature, right? Overnight was a big feature. We got rid of the overnight, at least here in the district. Our burglary,
yeah.
Although we still listen, daytime or at night. Well, just to be clear, that was without talking about kind of the more general purposes again of kind of privacy, protection of privacy, of security, of kind of the higher risk that you might have in some of these locations. I think a lot of the more modern scholarship and some of the more modern statutes reflect that, and they sometimes get away from dwelling as the centerpiece for how you deal with that. Again, those are usually the locations where people have the most heightened sense of privacy and security, and are more vulnerable if there were to be a violent incident that happened there. But not always, and so. Anyway, don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good on this one, because we certainly didn't either.
My next one is payment card.
Payment card, you bet.
I didn't get a chance because obviously I read before they before I read anything else. Where is payment card come out?
Credit card fraud, which is now payment card fraud.
Okay. So payment card fraud.
Yeah.
I was thinking about this the other day.
Yeah.
If I used your PayPal account,
yeah.
Is that payment card fraud? Should it be payment card fraud, even though it's not a card?
Yeah.
It doesn't fit into your definition.
That's right.
Doesn't it tie into a card?
Well, no.
PayPal,
so,
no.
PayPal, no. And so we would say no. That is to say, right now, basically, we were trying to do this based off of the current.
Your bank account or a credit card.
It can, but
I think you put funds in it.
Don, stepping up. I'm not surprised.
Your bank account, your credit card, and an independent account that is maintained by PayPal.
That's right. You can
choose any of those three to make a payment.
Right. So I guess what we would say is the instrument portion here is important, which is to say, if it's just, for instance, your online account, your online version of a PayPal account, right, that somebody has the PIN for, and or takes and uses you online using whatever PIN and access you need, that alone would not get you into the credit card box. That payment card is trying to tether these kinds of intellectual property notions, and we have credit, we have all these kinds of exchanges going on, but here we're talking about, is it tied to a physical card, an instrument of any kind? Now there are, again, various types of instruments. The interesting thing, if you dig at this, because this is a non-exclusive definition, right? So we've got including an instrument known as a credit card or debit card. But it's issued for the use of the cardholder for obtaining or paying for property or the number inscribed in such a card. Library cards, membership cards, again, get you a right to a service. They're tied to a person, have a physical, again, there needs to be some sort of physical instrument, but it's a broad thing. And
does it have to be a physical instrument? So, for example, I know all of my credit card information down to all those little numbers front and back by heart. Why does it have to involve, people take that now in lieu of the physical thing.
That's
since
right.
Payment card includes the number and description.
Or the number inscribed on it.
But it's still tied to a card.
It's still tied to the card, yeah.
That's right.
Okay.
And again, in going this route, it's a route which both we have in the current kind of credit card offense. Let's see if I can find that.
Wait. Use library card?
So,
if Netflix starts sending out cards?
Or a gym membership. You know, you steal my gym membership, Laura, because you're...
Are you making fun of me? And you need to move on. Let's go back to Netflix.
So we're all...
This is why it goes a step too far. This is what broke everything.
So I just want to understand the logic of it. So somebody uses my PayPal that's tied to my Visa account.
Yep.
It creates one set of offenses. But if I tie my PayPal to a different account, it's no longer a crime. It's no longer that crime. And is that the distinction we want to draw?
Can someone explain, or maybe it's Don, what's the third thing? How's that work? Then they send you a check? I mean, they say,
it's like having
a,
it's like having a credit with PayPal. So it's like, imagine.
That's just like any other business that offers you credit.
They offer you the money in advance.
So you can get credit on your
So they'll
Amazon
send
account.
You a bill, and then you'll like pay them instead out of your of checking, your credit, your what, credit card, whatever. Is that
or what you will have is a credit in your PayPal account that they collect interest on, right? They love to do that while you get no interest on it, and they'll keep it there for you until you want to spend it.
So it's like a prepaid.
So you could look,
which that's what made it think that it sort of should be treated the same way.
Because maybe you're a person who can't get a credit card. So what you do is you have cash for some reason, yet you can't get a credit card. So you prepay this account to PayPal, and the business for them is that they collect interest on it. Then when you want to pay a merchant, you don't have a card to use on the internet, you use the PayPal account, and they pay them for it.
Which is what made me think of it at like a debit account, because the difference is rather than going to your bank through your debit card, they're simply going to their own fund that your money is residing in. That's why I thought it was analogous.
Well, and
I don't use PayPal, but there's plenty of people that do.
Well, and look, there are a bunch of money services, but it's also again to the extent property includes obtaining services. That's where I was kind of going with library cards, gym memberships, I don't know what else, cards that, you might have, that, right, like, might be in a wallet that somebody might have, wrongfully obtained or used. There's a lot of stuff out there, gift certificates, you're saying, prepaid cards.
Gift cards.
The credit card fraud statute, so I have the current one up on the screen. The reason we just went with the payment card and tried to, it sounds like we broadened it, we actually didn't on this, right? So like, we felt like it was misleading to say the term credit card means an instrument or device, whether known as a credit card, debit card, or by any other name. I mean, because it almost like, it does apply to the debit card situation. So in terms of like, whether it's directly drawing on an account or whether it's credit, that seems irrelevant, right?
But not for the definition of payment card.
I'm sorry what do you think the distinction is?
Go back to credit card, I'm sorry.
Okay, so there's payment card.
Credit card means an instrument or device.
This means like your DC-1 card. I mean, this is... It's like any card...
Potentially. I mean, you've got identity theft, right? Which does like more...
I take it back. It doesn't.
But what is it payment? Because if you say that a library card falls into that, those are free, right? Or do you pay some nominal
fee?
Show you're a resident.
Same thing for using the Wilson
pool. And
then
you pay like a couple of dollars... But you're not paying them for the books. It's just a privilege that you have as a resident. So I don't understand why it's a payment card. It's literally
It's the problem with property, right? This is where we tripped into it with services, right?
So you have to have, you have to be a DC resident to go use a DC pool, right?
Yes.
That's a person who's
$7 otherwise.
Or you pay $7. So you're getting, so I actually, there's a reason I would steal that. I am a DC resident, but you know, why someone might be incentivized to use somebody else's card to be able to go into the, to have the service of the pool.
Right.
Or the service of the library, even though it's not hard to get, right?
Right. But like, yeah, your
but
kids
because it's
go
a
to
card,
the
it's
auditorium,
this?
And then you got friends using the other kids.
And it's credit card
ID.
Fraud?
I mean, look, again, we're I.
Okay,
one
sorry.
Is the question: are
right,
we kind
sorry.
Of mirroring
yeah.
where current law is? And I think we are. Now the breadth of that, I agree, and this is why, like, I just raised these. You know, there hasn't been litigation about this, like, but we, in thinking about this, right, we were coming up with, you know, these library cards, these other things, where again. Now, you know, there's some agreement you sign when you get a library card, and it's, you know, I will be liable, right, you know, for, you know,
non-return books.
For non-return books, or maybe I'm, it's, I don't know, what, you know, nobody reads the fine print on these things except for Dave. But
highlights it.
But right, you know, so it is.
You should have seen when I took the mortgage on my house, how long they sat there.
Oh, dear.
But no one else will sell the house.
Okay, I'm going to have people say, what do you do? No one else reads that.
Yeah. It's just the standard form.
Yeah, no, exactly. It's
well,
worth thinking about the breadth of this.
There.
Exactly. I mean, I will say this too. And this goes to the provision on aggregation of multiple convictions, right? Like, look. This is a particular form of fraud. Often, that kind of activity, you know, if it's a taking of a credit card, right, or a misuse of a credit card or a gift certificate or anything else, whether we conceive it as credit card fraud in the current statute or the revised statute, or more generally as fraud, right, a taking of property of another by deception, you know, I guess I would say again, the nub of it is that there is some misuse, unauthorized use of property of another, particularly in the whether it's a permanent in the sense of deprivation, whether it's temporary. We have again TPWR, the kind of equivalent of that now called unauthorized use of property. Again, kind of which might more naturally kind of fit with where you would think. You know, a use of somebody else's library card, for instance, if it's a very temporary thing, right? In the end, while we're carving up this conduct into a payment card fraud offense, I think the conduct is still, to some degree, improper and illegal, right? Like, under both current law, and we're translating that over. So, Yep. So again, misuse of another person's library card. Where is that going to go? I think again, we do have an unauthorized use of property, which is similar to the current TPWR offense. You know, for this very small level.
Seriously?
Yeah. Well, I know. Well, and for these trivial or not trivial. You know, theory, there would be no paper, right? Like, in theory, like, you know, significant criminal justice resources would not be invested in this. But, you know, there you go, right? You know, on these kind of de minimis kinds of issues, maybe in some time it is picked up. So, anyway. I just try to put that in the broader context of where's the fraud statute going? Do we have, you know, an unauthorized use of property statute that's very general, very low mental states, you know, very, very broad for the, you know, we talked before, the, you know, grabbing the neighbor's snow shovel right off their steps, right? You know, oh, it's temporary, I'm just returning it. We want to cover that kind of conduct, but again, grade it appropriately. Well,
it's neighborly.
It is neighborly.
That's unauthorized use of property.
Which is another offense,
that's
right?
Me reading.
There you go. I'm sorry. All right. Anything more on payment card fraud? I think again, like in the context of that offense, hopefully it'll work out. But yeah, it the breadth of the language, both in the current statute and our revised version, is something to be careful about. On the definition of property, I want to go back again to that. I will say, you know, so currently we have this in the code. Services includes, we just got rid of this, I believe. So when you look at other jurisdictions, we could go down this road. We decided not to and stick kind of closer to existing law. Many jurisdictions do have separate theft of services offenses, okay? So they usually don't divide up tangible and intangible property, but they often do distinguish within a general theft offense, kind of a consolidated theft offense, saying theft is this and it's punished by this, and here are the different forms, one of which is theft of services. The thought is it does entail, so this is how the model penal code does it, and then again a number of jurisdictions reflecting that. It is a different kind of thing to think about services, and the hypotheticals, the factual situations where it arises are a little bit different, right? It's somebody leaving without paying, right? Starting to receive, the benefit of the service and then leaving, the car's mostly been fixed and I just drive it off the lot without paying, admissions to places. So for whatever reason, the district has been one that's kind of taken this, in some sense, an even broader approach to consolidation and treated services exactly the same as any other form of property. So that's what we've been continuing. Theft of utility services is one that we have not, we did not address in this, but it's just one of the property offenses that we have not gotten to, right? Like, in theory, it again raises some distinct issues. You want kind of the actus reus elements of theft of utility services, like, people, you want some clear lines about what does that mean, and, if you're tapping into a phone, electrical line, and things like that.
What do you mean when you say have an interest in it?
Yeah, we did not. That was not one of the statutes that we revised, and it would just stay.
Like, you just left it.
That's right. It would just. Okay. Yeah, I think it has been charged once or twice in the last, five years.
Happens.
Yeah, it definitely happens. I think it's rarely charged, but I think it's a rare offense. And frankly, we just in our prioritization of things. Any other questions going through other definitions?
I'm sorry. Because I sometimes have notes in the main section.
Sure.
Sometimes I have notes in the commentary. So I apologize for going back. Financial injury.
Okay.
I. So financial injury includes lost time of wages or any similar monetary benefit while the person is seeking redress.
Yeah.
Right. There are other times where people we deal with have lost wages.
Yeah.
Right. So if I am meeting with my victims of a robbery, and they come to my office 2 days of sexual assault victim whatever, their lost wages are not for redressing of damages. I can't subpoena them to my office and they don't get witness fees. So isn't there other situations where there is financial injury and lost wages that are tied to the offense? So let me say, you get robbed,
okay.
And you come down to my office for 2 days.
Yep.
Are they going to pay you?
Yep.
I'm not. Right. Is that lost wages?
Yeah.
No.
Yeah. So this definitely is like, it's a line drawing exercise. Like, in theory, you know, the amount of time that victims, lost time that victims suffer in myriad ways, right, are myriad. And so partly this is, you know, what gets included, what not, what doesn't.
Which number is it?
Identity theft and financial exploitation.
Yeah.
So, you know,
so these are the two statutes.
What I really have to do, a lot of these notes are because I read eight before I read the rest.
Sure.
So what I really have to do is run the definitions through the offenses to see whether my comments apply or not. Because they may not, and I apologize for they may not apply within the context of the offense you're talking about. I actually was thinking about restitution when I wrote that, but that's probably has nothing to do with this.
Well, I will say, so Mike was just saying, where we use that financial injury term is right now in the financial exploitation of vulnerable adults, the FIVA statute, and identity theft. I believe the current identity theft, might have that.
It can't be
no,
that the conduct of the prosecutor.
No, I agree in this context. That's why I said that. I got to run it. I have to run these definitions through the actual offenses in the next three or four of them. So let at the risk of bringing that up again, look at motor vehicle. When does motor vehicle apply?
And there's at least one time is in trespass, and I think it's also a gradation of theft. So it's used in the theft gradation.
And UUV.
Oh, sorry, or UUV. Yeah.
You know.
Also in... There's like a breaking and entering of an
motor
vehicle.
Yeah.
That's
vehicular trespass.
Yeah, so it's like we have trespass to a motor vehicle as a... Either as a separate offense or as a grade of trespass. I forget what we decided.
I feel sorry for that person.
No, I did not say it. I know it. Because I am. And it is. So you get someone to my house now.
There's also like alteration of like a motor vehicle ID number. Is like it comes up in a lot of weird places in our code as well as in current law.
What was the last one you just said?
Like alteration of a motor vehicle identification number.
Oh,
so
right.
Like
sure,
the
VINs.
Yeah. So
there are
we
a couple of weird places were they?
And your was your concern about like just?
No, I just want to. There are other definitions of motor vehicle in the code other than the ones you chose.
That's right.
So there's another definition that has that include other appliances that move over a highway on wheels or traction tread.
Right.
That are other than merely internal combustion and
electric.
And electric.
Yeah.
And that's why I was wondering. I didn't want to. You know, so I don't. Yeah. I need to run it through. They maybe need to be included, depending on which the offenses are.
Yeah, and I think again, there's an array of offenses. I may be wrong about this, but you know, I don't believe Rachel would be the one to correct me on this. That any places we used this new definition, it changed. Existing law. Again, I know you have some Title 50. You know, there's a lot of other stuff out there, and you know, this wouldn't apply to that. Right.
Again, I'll write it through before I send in any comments on it, just to see whether those other types of motor vehicles should be included.
Yeah.
Should be considered included.
I will say we. You know, in some sense, it does broaden in some places. Motor vehicle, as we've used, pull up the commentary entry on this too. While it has the specific list, you know, the residual or other vehicle propelled by an internal combustion engine or electricity, including any non-operational vehicle that is being restored or repaired. One thing that it can include too is potentially boats, right? Which sometimes are listed separately, and we there's some trespass, and some of the trespass offenses we wrestled with this. So I would say, if anything, on the margins, if this definition might expand a bit in some, like, trespass or something, where, like, watercraft was treated differently under the current statute.
Yeah, so it would expand. It's a question of the gradation under your bill.
That's right. So all this is, like, we'd have to look at it in the particular offense, and I don't know.
The current UE motor vehicle statute does not have a definition for motor vehicle, and there has been no case law so far that's interpreted it. So at least as far as that goes, it's unclear whether this would expand it or not.
Right.
Okay.
Yep. Other questions? We try to deal with this. The RISE definition adds all terrain vehicles and mopeds to the list of specific vehicles. Oh. DCCA, whatever.
The next thing I've got is a typo. You got on page 33.
There we go.
Footnote 226. No, they don't want any official correspondence. They want your view, right? The definition of a person, I think, is 223201-3, now 2238.
Oh, my God.
The things you happen to know when you look at this stuff.
Okay, sorry, page 32.
The meeting's not over, right?
I didn't want to put it in the
lights out.
It's a wrap.
And it's also on page 34. Footnote 253.
You're not putting a letter. And you get
the
bus from OH, you're just going to make sure it's stopped. You don't have that one.
Not that it's OMG.
It's
all
going in one place.
Just those two footnotes.
Excellent. Excellent. Right. I think I've got them. We'll track them down then. Yes. Any other issues on definitions? I will say, value again. We hewed very closely to case law, but that is new, right? To actually codify a detailed definition of value as we are. It's, again, not rocket science, and for most of the part, it's, fair market value under current case law. But I would just point out that, right, now we actually have a definition on this. It's,
okay, sorry.
Sure.
Page 40. You say C. This is, we're dealing on page 39. Oh, value, I'm sorry.
Mm-hmm.
Value means, and it says, notwithstanding subsections A and B, the value of a payment part is X, or another goes down.
Yes.
And what I assume you mean is the value of a unused payment card.
Well, here's
because what, if they use the credit card for $25,000 and buy a boat,
that's right.
Then I'm assuming the value is $25,000.
That's right. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
It's only the That was my suggestion, was to add unused into that.
So it's unused or used below, or theoretically used below that value.
Yes.
We'll see if we can tweak the language on that. What we wanted to communicate too is that, like, in instances where, like,
it's just
the car, right?
No, that's what exactly. I got. But I would hate to get into an argument.
I know.
But the card's value was $25,000 to the person. Yeah. They bought a boat.
That's right. Well, okay. We will, either through both the statutory language and the commentary, see if we can tweak that. Again, unused news. We certainly do mean to cover both of those instances. As the commentary kind of explains on that point, there's some jurisdictions have done this. It's not, but it's somewhat unusual to kind of set an arbitrary value for these things. it's a practical solution to the problem, right? Which has been batted around before is how to grade this. It's not nothing. It's not everything. So how do you do this? And part of the thought was, you know, look at it. I would suggest, you know, looking at it too, because probably what we were considering is like, right, like a typical wallet, right? Or, like the theft of a wallet usually contains what? One credit card, debit card, you know, two, three, you know, on the average, you know, where should that put you then in terms of, you know, what theft gradation is? That is that a felony theft? Is it a low felony theft? You know, like, so whatever that X ends up being, that's the kind of mental exercise, you know, I think is appropriate. In all cases where it's actually used, that provides the value, certainly. Any other questions? Okay. Anything else on definitions? So in the first, the report eight, the other two things that are addressed are the again the aggregation statute.
One more thing about definitions.
Sure.
I'm sorry to do this, but I don't want a discussion about it, but I still might be asserting to read definitions before the terms have been used in the penalty section.
I'm sorry.
I know maybe like a year and a half ago or a year ago, we had a discussion about having the definitions follow the offense and precede the penalties.
Yep. So you're talking about organizationally in a given offense,
yeah.
Where should the definitions go? Do they go at the beginning or at the end, or how to do that?
Table that as something to think about at a future date.
That's fair. And I would say more generally, too, when we think about, you'll see as we drafted these property offenses, right? Like, they're just drafting choices, too. And, like, some of this is just style, like, I consider this, you know, it's an organizational style point. Do you put the definitions, subsection A, and then the offense in B, and penalties in C? Do you rearrange it? If folks have thoughts on those, you know, just, you know, let us know.
Honestly, to some extent, we do what we're supposed to do, and what Dave is clearly very focused on. If you get the definitions consistent across offenses, it's not that you just are defining them for a particular offense. There are going to be some things that are defined maybe at the beginning or at the end, but it's wherever you see this in title, whatever, that's what it means.
Yeah. I'll give an example of Renata is saying this is definitely true, and it's even a problem across subtitles. So for instance, here I put up, you know, our revised theft offense, and it right now what we've done, this is kind of standard, we do the offense and kind of the definition first in A, immediately followed by definitions. But here's what we've been doing is we've been putting in cross references where it's a standardly used thing. And this is kind of, again, our compromise, right? Which is to say, we're not gonna, in every one of these, keep repeating the definition of property and property of another and owner and consent and all of this. But at the same time, these are technically defined, and it can be misleading to know that, like, oh yeah, you have to go back 40 pages or to this other, you know, place to find the actual definition. So what we've tried to do is this. Again, some jurisdictions, you know, there's some precedent for doing this. It seems to be the compromise between not making it bulky in each offense to keep repeating the relevant definitions to that offense, and yet to provide a hook and a pointer to where they are. So, again, this is just kind of a drafting style choice. Don, your point was, am I correct in thinking you would prefer to have the definitions be first in order?
Or last.
But not right after the...
Right, after the gradations and penalties. Because some of the things that come up in gradations and penalties have to be defined.
Yeah, they're... Yeah. It's a... Yep.
and don't occur in
right,
the,
exactly.
the definition
sure.
of the offense.
Yeah.
They only occur in the penalty.
In the penalties.
Yeah.
So the definitions refer to things that both precede and follow the definition, which is not wrong in any sense. It's just a little disconcerting for the reader.
You bet. I will
Can
say,
I give my preference?
Sure, please.
I would hate to see all of our statutes start with theft definitions.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So if the choices are first or last, my vote is theft means, robbery means, and then get to the definitions again for people who aren't familiar with it to have them. I understand why you're putting them in there. But to me, they're not, for the typical practitioner,
go to the beginning.
You want to look at the code, you want to know what theft is, you want to look at what's going to catch your eye at the beginning.
So you would order that A, C, B?
Right. Yeah. Yeah, there may be a D, though.
Yeah. Well, then
If those are the choices.
That's
but it's
right.
like an index, at, like
that's
you have the end of a textbook or whatever that.
That's right.
So you just know where to look.
Yeah.
I mean, otherwise, you can have the same list in every offense of definitions all through property, all through assaults, and that's going to get tedious right out of the book.
I agree.
Also, as a stylistic matter, those things need to be separated, not by commas, I think, but by
semicolons.
Yes.
Good.
And then we'll not put that.
Semicolons and the organizational. No, and look, this is helpful. And like, just as a drafting matter, right? Like, yeah. If you have other thoughts on that, those both make sense. I will say, you know, right. The court has in the past said things about code reform, like, we support this, but you know, can you try to organize it so that it creates the least amount of like changing of numbers and subsections? I think, you know, these mechanics, right?
The court or the council?
The court, actually, like in testimony.
Oh, yeah.
Is like,
for
Rufus King testifying.
Charge tracking purposes. They then look up what is a 22401.
Exactly.
But I don't think that'll be for us because we're creating a whole new code section.
I agree. But my point would be it's nice to standardize it, and it's nice to always have, you know, whatever the section is, A is going to give you your definition, B is going to give you your penalty. It would make the world, and goodness knows, right now the current code doesn't have that. You know, it's kind of all scattered sometimes. The penalties are in their own sections. So standardizing this,
I'm convinced.
Yeah, here we go.
ABC.
The data people would feel the love for, you know, being consistent on this and, like, keeping
and yet,
it.
The law was not
well, and, you know, flexible. All right. Other thoughts. Again, I go back to the aggregation and a limitation on conviction for multiple related offenses, if there are any questions or concerns. Both of these do new things. Aggregation is expanded. We're adding to aggregation. And then the big changes to move from the consecutive sentencing statute to both expand that list and then limit the number of convictions. So it's not just you can be convicted, multiple convictions for these things, but they have to be concurrently sentenced. Instead to say, at least for certain groupings, you only get the most serious charge, which is similar to how the sentencing, you know, guidelines work currently in practice for all property offenses. Those are the changes, big changes.
That's probably gave my office the biggest heartburn out of anything we've done so far.
Yep.
So let's talk through the limitations on convictions.
Okay.
So you got your theft, your fraud, your extortion, whatever.
Yep.
And then the government proves it all.
Yep.
The jury comes back.
Yep.
The judge only sentences on theft.
Yep.
Then the Court of Appeals overturns the theft because of some element only on the theft.
Yep.
Then you go back to resentencing.
Yep.
And then you go for your next appeal. Right? Because you can't appeal the issues on the first appeal because there are an offense to which you were not convicted. Mm-hmm. So we not only have now multiple sentencings, we have multiple appeals.
Mm-hmm.
All right, both the work and the time that goes into that. Mm-hmm. So that gave the people in my office a lot of heartburn. Mm-hmm. And the suggestion that we had instead, mm-hmm. as a compromise, is to treat it like merged offenses. So the way that we do merged offenses, and you guys can correct me if I'm saying something wrong, is that it is only after the court of either the appeal time ends, or after the appeal time ends, or after an unsuccessful appeal, that it then goes back to the trial court for the removal of the other convictions, because they merge it. To us, that then allows a single sentencing and a single set of appeals that cover all the issues. So this is going to be,
sure.
for us, yeah. the biggest one, and that's
sure.
what we propose as an alternative.
Yeah, and I think I would say, like, the procedural hurdles on any, like, it's just procedurally, new procedures are going to be required on any of these.
No,
fronts.
We already do it for mergers.
Well,
so people know how to handle it.
On,
so,
right, on merger. If merger is not one of the issues appealed by the defendant.
No, I'm saying is using merger as the model for this. So the person gets convicted of all the offenses,
mm-hmm.
the defense gets to appeal it all,
yep.
one appeal,
yep.
and however the Court of Appeals ends up deciding,
yep.
you then withdraw the lessors that you would have not had them sentenced.
But if it's not, if there is no appeal,
then the time
or
runs.
It's not,
I'm sorry.
Yes, then what is the signal
What's
about
the
what should
yeah.
happen?
Then at the end of the 30 days appeal time, the court should remove the other convictions.
Gotcha. So gotcha. It would be like an automatic
removal. Yeah.
Okay.
Your office is not against the merger. It's not against the policy. It's just a question of the implementation.
What we don't want is multiple, is three sentencings and three appeals on
right.
the same case.
Right.
Okay.
The success of appeals really is going to drive people nuts.
Yeah. I will say, like, and it may be that is a more common practice. Researching this, trying to figure out how other jurisdictions deal with this, it's been mind-blowing, right? Because, right, it just gets into, you know, the procedural minutiae of different jurisdictions. So that makes sense as a way to kind of get to the same end. And the more you could flesh that out in you know, either orally, we can talk, or,
yeah.
or in writing would be great. Because I think, like, the devil's in just, like, right, articulating how that works.
Yeah, I can. I'll draft. I'll end up drafting a letter if we don't
That'd
do
great.
It otherwise.
Yeah, yeah.
But that would be OAG's
yeah.
proposal
great.
On handling. So it gets
yeah.
you guys
yeah, yeah.
everywhere where they want to get.
Yeah.
Without what we consider multiple extra hearings. Of
sure.
Appeals.
Sure. That seems a reasonable. Well, yeah. Seems
okay.
reasonable. Any other kind of initial thoughts from others on that, or I think, you know, again, whatever this is, like, we just don't want it to be a mess, right? Like, and so, you know, providing some clarity on this. Again, I, you know, I yeah. Well, if there are no other thoughts on those points, turn to the theft memo. And again, I don't want to get ahead if folks are... wishing to go there today. But so report number 9, again, got the kind of the core theft offenses. That we've addressed. You know, structurally, I will say again, the revised unauthorized use of a property, this is the TPWR type equivalent, right? A minor misdemeanor level. It doesn't have aspartation as an element like, you know, current TPWR, right? So it cleans that up. And it ends up being a lesser included, even for what I assume is going to be, you know, misdemeanor theft, right? It is Whereas, you know, theft here, the core offense still requires intent to deprive, right, the person of the property. By contrast, unauthorized use of property is really that simple. The only elements, you know, knowingly takes, obtains, transfers, exercises control, property of another, without effective consent. Now, one thing I'd say, to the extent that you, you know, kind of looking through this, and something we wrestled with is, so there's a reference here to effective consent, and, you know, what does that mean? We've kind of spelled that out. What we want to, ineffective consent may be the more intuitive place to start and think about that, which is consent obtained by threats or other form of coercion, application of force, violence. We wanted to be clear that, you know, again, different jurisdictions handle this differently, both in their statute, and yet in the case law, everybody kind of comes out in the same point, right? Which is to say, it's not real consent in any of these cases if it was consent obtained by fraud or, you know, extortion or threats or duress, you know? So we've tried to, like, make that clearer in the statute. So hopefully that doesn't get tripped up for anybody, and think about whether that structure works. You know, there are, we could break this out. We could say, you know, anyway, this is one model of kind of how to draft that point that we found in some other Texas, I think.
Texas, Tennessee.
Consent definition.
Sure. It's back up there. So yeah, there we have, like, again, like the cross reference there. The way we did it was, you know, the terms effective consent, etc., are mainly specified in 22A, 2001. So zoom over to that again. Did you want? I'm sorry, consent or effective consent?
Consent.
Okay. There we go. The consent definition is, you know, very similar to what we, the only place we have consent right now codified, correct me if I'm wrong, but, you know, is the sex abuse statutes, right? And case law is borrowed from that, referred to it at times, and yet it isn't like, you know, parts of it don't mix so well here. So we stuck with the core of it. This second part is going to be unique from our perspective to property offenses, right? So, like, you know, you wouldn't say that second sentence for sex abuse, right? But in the context of property offenses, if somebody, you know, says, hey, can I borrow the car? Or, you know, shrugs and is like, or, you know, is something that is, again, indifferent. I don't know. You know, is that sufficient or not? In property offenses, very different than offenses against persons, is our thought. In offenses against persons, no, that is not consent. In property offenses, it could be, right? You know, it just depends on the particular circumstances and those words or actions, but that might be adequate. Again, you know, the relationships are going to matter, right? You know, is it somebody who's, like, always borrowing the car and that kind of a routine thing, or a mumbled comment from, you know, the person who normally lends the car? It doesn't, you know, these sort of circumstances, it's going to be argued.
So no one else thinks it's problematic that we have this thing that looks like it's like a glossary type of definition, but then it's not actually the definition wherever it appears. Like, yeah, it's the definition of consent when it appears in the property offenses, but no, it's not the definition of offense of consent when it appears in these sexual assault offenses.
I was assuming that each kind of crime would have its own sense of definition.
But that's what I was
saying. It's the only way to work around it.
Well, and honestly, don't know yet. So
this is going to be a place where I think there can't be a consent in the big, I'm calling the big definitions.
Yeah.
Because it doesn't work.
That's right. Anywhere. That's right.
We got to be careful about that.
Well, and so what we would propose, and this is where it gets kind of like whiteboard. You know, like some definitions. Again, we're trying our best to make them consistent. You know, that's whatever. You know, part of our square mandate. But at times, as with this, there's going to be references to consent, obviously in offenses against persons, sex abuse, and here in property offenses. So what we've done is we've structured this as being at the subtitle level. So, like, you know, we've got, you know, they apply for this subtitle. Now, it's kind of a mess. And I will say, like, ideally, to the extent possible, we move them out to apply in the general provisions to apply to all offenses, right? But consent's one where we can't. Yeah,
right.
I
so
see
I
your point's valid.
Just
on,
thinking about where we are today, my thought was that we're going to have these things that apply everywhere. Motor vehicle, hopefully can just mean the same thing wherever it appears.
That's right.
Hadn't thought about consent, but clearly it's not going to. If that's going to be the definition,
that's right.
It can't work like that. So you can't have it in a big broad. It's got to be by subtitle or by offense if it hasn't been broken down.
Yeah.
Okay, now. What's the definition of effective consent?
Yeah.
Down below
there. So let me give you an example of something that I was going to raise before I did it, but it's something comes up here. So go back to consent. Consent means, right? Now let's say I get Renata drunk, because I do that from time to time. And then I asked her if I could borrow her car and she goes, no.
So there's no current...
Now, under effective consent, it's listed to duress or coercion, right? But arguably, her drunk nod should not be effective consent when I'm taking her vehicle.
So there's no district case law on intoxication with respect or incapacity. Well,
I was
cute.
I gave that as an example. But I was thinking.
Well, so the other context in which this arises and where the council even lately has struggled is with respect to people who are incapacitated due to a mental disability or age, right?
Yeah.
And like, it's just a whole thing. Effective consent includes coercion and deception, which are both of those terms are the ones that we've talked about that have been defined in the property definition sections. So as far as effective consent goes, incapacity is not in there. And there's, as far as I know, no case law in property offenses that deal with incapacitation with respect to consent. I would say, again, consent includes words or actions that indicate an agreement. So you could imagine getting Renata so wasted and you pretend that, oh yeah, Renata did give me consent.
No, I can actually. I'm not even going that far.
I'm just going to hug blood.
Which seems to me is that second sentence, right? That's the second sentence, right?
Oh, yeah. Well, so then you'd have to ask, all right, so it sounds like she's given consent.
Then
you'd have to ask, is that consent effective? Well,
it's not the coercion or duress.
Yeah. So I think it's
effective consent.
What would happen is you would argue about was it consent in the first place, not so much
the
effective.
And that's what I was getting at.
Yeah.
Okay, so a couple of things here.
Yeah.
Like, just as a simple matter, person who is new to this, a lay person, is not going to think that there's somewhere else they got to be looking. They're going to go, well, I wonder what consent is. And they're going to look under C's for consent. They are not going to think to look four or five definitions down for something that starts with an E called effective consent, which impacts that definition. So, you know what I'm saying? What consent is ought to include what ain't consent. And all of that. I mean, it ought to include everything that counts as consent and everything that would not be consent. I don't think there ought to be like little offshoots, because one, people may not think to look somewhere else for those things. The other reason is because if the definition is working right, it ought to be, shouldn't it be in one place? Like, you shouldn't have to have Dave's hypothetical.
So the problem, I think, with Dave's hypothetical is a question of the policy. And the District of Columbia has no policy right now, such that we can find case law or statute with respect to intoxication and consent with respect to property fences. So it's just, we don't know. And we didn't set any policy in this statute. This is a translation, more or less, of a close, or at least a close-ish translation of the policies embodied in the current D.C. property law.
So what do you
But that's a separate issue from your other point.
So we're done, right, okay, yeah. So... Yeah.
Your other point, Stina.
I want to see it all in one place. You know, I don't think it makes sense to say, have the consent shall not include blah, blah, blah somewhere else, or other stuff that qualifies as consent includes
sort
over
like
somewhere else.
Paragraph
it ought to be
E
somewhere
in the C,
else.
Right? Provided that it doesn't include X.
Well, so the,
exactly.
The problem is that sometimes we're using consent solo in the offense definitions, and sometimes we're using effective consent solo in the offense definitions. So fraud is taking with consent obtained by deception. Extortion is taking with consent obtained by coercion, right? Now, sometimes there are cases where we want to include both of those things into one concept. So Richard mentioned as a possibility, for example, if we go to UUP or TPWR, you could
unauthorized use of property.
Unauthorized use of property. You could list without consent, with a consent obtained by deception, with consent obtained by coercion.
Unpack it.
Unpack and not have a definition of effective consent. So it's a drafting choice. So we could do that.
I think I'm used to things being set up in the latter way.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, and it's, you know, when you think about where the Red Book construction is going to be, right? It's probably going to be that, right? Like, it would bring those in and unpack them, or whatever. Sometimes Red Book, they put in the definitions at the bottom and bracket it. But yeah, I definitely...
I hate those Red Book.
those Red Book people. They make the world go round, I will say. But for the Red Book... But for the Red Book, we would be left with these stats.
And
the current
it's so funny, when we started this, I said, I don't understand. What is this code project thing?
You know what we're doing,
the Red Book?
Red Book, doesn't that just take care of it? Yeah.
Exactly.
Yeah, there you go. There you go, exactly. Voluntarily on purpose, not by mistake or accident.
Yes. Yes.
What more do you need?
It's work for us.
What do you mean there, Beth?
Sort of.
Exactly.
Sort of.
Yeah, it,
sort of.
It does.
Sort of.
It's sort of.
I mean,
okay. Okay.
All right.
Blue haven't updated the Red Book relationship because it's not.
We got it at least, you know.
Mine's all in there. Oh, that's what I was doing instead of.
You haven't even unpacked your own.
It's in, I believe it.
Sad. It's sad. We're on the line.
That's such disrespect.
All right. I don't know that. Do other people even have them, though, besides the Red Book Committee people? I'm just kind of. Anyway.
They have been distributed at my office.
They have. You guys are on it. You know.
The what?
The Red Book.
The little inserts.
You've already gotten them?
Yeah.
Oh, we won't get them until the next fiscal year.
Yeah, see, this is what we've got.
I got mine.
We got a special
I got
gift copy, but yeah, exactly.
We spend our money on stuff.
Because you don't care so much about that.
Yeah.
All right, moving on.
Okay.
Are there other questions? You know, we're almost at 4 o'clock, but are there specific questions anybody wanted to raise on theft offenses at this point?
So
not to make sure you actually, I found that particularly upsetting,
that last discussion. I'm
going to
go back and read through that again, but that was, like, really unnerving for me.
I can't read this. I can't.
Yeah.
What?
I'm going to read it too. I'm unnerved.
All right.
I might be.
All right. Yeah. That might be a wrap then.
Yeah. It's a wrap,
I'm feeling.
Unless David's found a typo here.
Everybody's getting crunchy.
Oh, I did, actually.
Yeah, it's funny.
If you want to go with it.
Sentencing.
Yeah, I only say this because you brought it up.
Yeah.
But in gradation theft, in 2A, isn't it a motor vehicle is in fact 25,000 or more?
Sorry.
I'm only bringing it up. Yep. She brought it up.
Where?
Oh, we had the in fact before the colon, I think. Was that the... on the screen, is that what
in
you're
fact, looking at? One, the property is in fact is valued to $2,000, or the property in fact is a motor vehicle and the value of the motor vehicle is $25,000. It should be in fact 25, because in fact doesn't, unlike the other mental states, go to the
That's
next
right.
clause.
Oh!
Well, so...
they're never going to concede it. He's going to be like, oh, you don't know, subpart rule five. Go ahead.
Just to confirm, so it is that up here on the screen.
I'm not usually on Dave's side, but this one I want to see.
Yeah. No, but I'm saying...
So
you're saying it should go in front of $25,000.
And you're saying both places. Because it doesn't carry through.
Because
of the
colon. You wouldn't
be
creating
a colon rule.
So, you know, honestly,
I got thrown by the
colon. Right, it is, and it's, you know, this is another, like, drafting style issue that's, like, legit to raise because, you know, at times we would otherwise, we bulk up with the repetition of in fact.
Yeah.
So what we've done to try to, you know, deal with this is we say the following phrase. So what we've done is in fact colon. Bryson was our proof with it. So I thought Renee, what?
That wasn't the colon. That's the first time I've seen that colon.
All right, seriously, it's been great.
Because of the...
All right.
We don't do memos. We do
except that. Okay.
So there you go. Not as formal
great.
As everyone else.
All right, so thank you all. And again, because this was like kind of inserted as the makeup meeting, it's actually only 2 weeks from tomorrow that our next meeting is. Again, it's October 4th. And again, so thefts and property offenses are both in this report number 9. And then number 10 is fraud offenses. I would suggest these are fair game. We're happy to meet with you if you want to, like, you know, talk and figure stuff out or have questions, you know, call us too. If it's just, you know, you're like reading this and you're just like, well, I don't know about that. But, you know, we can try to explain at least, you know, kind of where we're coming from because hopefully it's not a substantive difference. Yeah. Thank you all for your time and patience and forthrightness on the public record.